everywhere, and welcome to Economics in 10 with Pete and Gav. This is season 7 of our award-winning podcast, and in each episode, we look at a famous economist and ask 10 questions that will hopefully inform you and get you thinking about their influence in modern society today. In fact, bring out the bunting. This is our 50th episode.
Who'd have thought it?
Yes, we've made 50 of these. Unbelievable stuff. That's nearly 2 days worth of content for your listening pleasure. Anyway, who are we looking at today, Pete? And why is he still so relevant?
So, today, Gavin, we are looking at the life and work of Robert Lucas Jr. And in some respects, this is something of an obituary or a eulogy, because he's relatively recently deceased. And the reason why he has incurred such fame in the field of economics, he is associated with the concept of rational expectations. And like all sort of illustrious economists, he has one or two things named after him as well. The Lucas Critique.
He's got loads named after him.
Yeah. And he is one of our Nobel laureates. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1995.
For his work on rational expectations.
Yeah, funnily enough, yeah. According to Mankiw, he is the most influential macroeconomist of the last quarter of the 20th century.
Yeah, big talk.
Yeah. And in 2020, he was ranked as the 10th most cited economist in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, obviously, he's the economist's economist.
Yeah.
Have you ever been cited?
No.
Do you know what? It's quite amusing. There is an oceanographer with the same name as myself. Yeah, right. Peter Clift. Yeah. And I must have signed up to some kind of try and get some free access to some academic papers or something. But somehow, I think I've indicated that I might be him. So every now and then I get are you the Peter Clift who wrote a paper on plate tectonics?
I'm nice.
Like, no.
have you listened to our podcast? How you get it? Been cited in personal statements, haven't we?
I'm not sure quite how.
Prestigious?
Prestigious, that is. Well, perhaps it is. Yeah. Perhaps it is. We'll take it anyway.
Yeah.
So his most famous work, he published a groundbreaking paper in 1972 called Expectations and the Neutrality of Money.
Yeah.
Sounds like a right riveting read, as they say. And so what I suppose he's ultimately responsible for, as we'll see, is a kind of demolition job on the Phillips curve.
And Keynesianism.
And yeah, I suppose Keynesianism more generally.
Yeah.
In some respects, there's a sort of straw man element to this, as we might see, in that Phillips himself perhaps wouldn't have advocated the use of his work in the way it was used. And, you know, what Keynes actually meant by some of his own theories, you know, in terms of demand management, you know, fine-tuning, if you like, would he have advocated that? Or would his sort of demand management sort of prescription been sort of been made out only in extreme times? So anyway,
we'll find this with Lucas. I mean, this is the thing, is that obviously he has his theory, but, you know, having kind of watched him, he always kind of says, well, don't take my opinion for it. There's loads of opinions out there.
Yeah.
And I think that's quite, you
refreshing.
Know, yeah, refreshing.
Another Nobel laureate, Edward Prescott, once said he could think of no paper in economics as important as Lucas's paper in 1972. Mm. And Gary Becker, who we must do an episode on.
Yeah.
In some respects, I'm amazed we haven't done one already.
Yeah.
Said that initially, Lucas's research was met with hostility, but it came to be accepted as the view of the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in some respects, to simplify it, as we'll see, he certainly finished off the Phillips curve as a policy tool, even if Phillips never intended it to be used as one.
I'd be surprised if it was taken with that much hostility because of where it was coming from, University of Chicago, who were kind of in control of economics anyway.
Well, I'm not sure they were at that point. I think this is sort of pre the kind of ascendancy of Friedman. Well, maybe you're in the sort of takeover
phase. Rising up.
Yeah. I mean, that's the sort of back end of Keynesianism. It's, at its most sort of influential, I would say.
So, yeah. But as we found out from like Daly's, podcast, they were sort of already in control of like the big publishing or whatever, you know, like the magazines or the associations, weren't they?
Right, okay.
Yeah. So, anyway.
So, we'll talk a little bit about his life. I'm not going to talk too much about his sort of times because he's kind of 20th century man. You know, sometimes when we've looked at economists who are more historic, then we might sort of talk a little bit about the context in which they their ideas sort of grew up, if you like. But in some respects, like many 20th century economists, or in some respects, maybe all 20th century macroeconomists, their work is either a reaction to, or at the very least is written in the shadow of the Great Depression. Yeah. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And he talks a lot about his father, doesn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. And we'll talk a little. So we'll kick off. Give a little sort of detail about his life story. And I am drawing quite heavily on his own sort of biography, his biographical article he wrote for the sort of Nobel Prize sort of organization. They are always really interesting. Yeah. Well, not always, but quite often they're very interesting. So he is born on the 15th of September 1937 and died relatively recently, 15th of May 2023. He was born Robert Emerson Lucas Jr., a.k.a. Bob. I think he was often known as Bob to his friends. Yeah,
Bob to us.
Yeah, we'll call him Bob. Yeah. So his parents ran an ice creamery in Yakima. But as we sort of talked about the Great Depression, this was a victim of the Great Depression, that particular sort of entrepreneurial activity. And so during World War II, which comes hot on the heels of sort of Lucas's birth, the family moved to Seattle, and his dad at that point finds work as a steam fitter in the shipyards. I imagine actually there must be a lot of sort of work in the shipyards at that point.
Yeah.
Either in sort of, you know, creating sort of ships to sell to the Brits, or, you know, to sort of fund the war, fuel the war effort. Yeah, so imagine he was a busy man. And his mother as well resumed her earlier career as a fashion artist. And a brother, Daniel, is born in 1948. His dad as well works as a welder with a refrigeration company. And there is a real rags-to-riches story with his dad. He kind of moves up from being a craftsman, a sales engineer, a sales manager, and eventually president of the company. Yeah. You know, that is real sort of American dream stuff. So he's not, you know, his dad's got no college degree, no engineering training, and just learned stuff from sort of either other people or from handbooks. So real rags to riches stuff.
But I think that is an important point to just recognise there.
Yeah.
That his future kind of work on development economics and economic growth, he's very much into human capital being absolutely essential.
Yeah.
And learning from other people. So you don't want to be learning in isolation. You know, so he says, like, oh, I worked at the University of Chicago because I've got all these brilliant brains around me. And having those brilliant brains around me, I learn. And he says that, you know, doesn't he, about how, you know, no engineering training and learn the engineering he needed from the people he worked with and from handbooks.
Yeah.
I remember many technical managerial discussions with him, as well as ongoing political arguments. So already at that early age and through his dad, he was kind of witnessing the importance of education, you know, to grow within his family, but also the importance just more generally.
Yeah. And his parents are Democrats, so sort of New Deal Democrats, if you like, even though a lot of their sort of social peers tended to be Republicans.
Yeah.
And probably it's fair to say throughout the course of his life, Lucas moves away from
his
parents' position.
Yeah.
They're not easily. I think he appears to be, you know, the certainly from his biog, you get an impression of someone who's quite close to his parents. And I don't know, we all have differing opinions from our parents.
And that's nice, isn't it? It's nice. Mm. But I think, again, he sort of says that, is that, and I think, as I've already kind of alluded to in this lecture that I watched, where he goes, look, these are my opinions, you know, you can have your own. And it's that seems to have been taught by him by his parents, like, you know, we're this, but look, let's discuss, let's debate. And isn't that so refreshing these days?
It,
I think we've talked about this before, haven't we?
Yeah.
You know, about listening to each other. And I saw this quote of someone said about when you talk to Bob, you either agree quickly with him or you don't. And that's it. Like, you know, but it's not, it doesn't seem to be antagonism.
No. You know? I mean, we'll come on to this later, but he does, whatever one might think of his economic views or his the implied sort of political views, he seems like a thoroughly nice chap. So he does describe his dad, and it's sort of just, I'll quote him just to illustrate the point you've just made. He said, "I remember many technical and managerial discussions with him, as well as our ongoing political arguments. When I took calculus in high school, he enlisted my help on a refrigeration design problem he was working on and actually used my calculations. It was my first taste of real applied mathematics and an exciting one."
No, we can't imagine that, can we?
No, I mean, it did make me think, actually, doing DIY with my dad. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
He'd always be in a state of mild fury, you know.
Same with me, like my dad looking at a car. And I'd be like, "Stenner, anything I could do?"
And he'd be like, he'd go and get a plier. And I'd go away. You couldn't ask him twice because he'd sort of probably get a sort of a chisel lump thrown at your head or something. But it's a bit of a running joke in our family, you know, the snub-nosed pliers. And we'd be like, "What the hell, the snub-nosed pliers?" He'd completely lose it with us when we came back with the wrong tool. Anyway, but it sounds like a very different relationship between Lucas and his father. So he goes to various public schools, which, of course, in America are state schools, as opposed to here in the UK, where a public school would be a private fee-paying institution. And he gets a scholarship to Chicago rather than MIT. So in some respects, that means he can't go on to do what at the time was his chosen career of engineering. His parents are basically quite happy for him to sort of go on to sort of further education, but only if he's got a scholarship. And he sort of starts with maths, but then becomes really interested in the liberal arts, you know, courses like the history of Western civilization, principles of knowledge. I mean, I do actually think this is where America, and I might be my ignorance and not knowing enough about America, but I just think a liberal arts degree sounds fascinating, where you can sort of specialise in a whole range of different things. Certainly for someone like, you know, myself, quite mathematical, but interested in literature, interested in history, you could sort of move in whatever direction you wanted to within sort of a degree like that. And my niece actually did a very similar programme at a Dutch university in Maastricht. And you just think, it really does allow you to sort of grow and then choose a direction without sort of specialising too early.
A lot of students nowadays are thinking, aren't they, because maybe some options are a bit more limited at top universities, that, you know, I've heard that many are looking stateside for, you know, education. So maybe someone could be listening here and feel inspired by that, Pete.
Anyway, so he starts with maths, but he's excited by these more sort of humanities type courses and ends up majoring in history. Very briefly, he goes to Berkeley to do history because he's got a real interest in sort of classical history, but he doesn't have Latin or Greek. And probably then, as now, that's a bit of a break if you really want to get deep into sort of that kind of field. So it's back to Chicago. I mean, in some respects, that's so true today. Unless you're educated privately in this country, very difficult to get into sort of this genuine study of the classics, like Latin and Greek. Though I would like to give a shout out to an organisation called Classics for All, who are trying to promote sort of the classics in the state sector. Yeah, so there we are.
Have you? Because through that, his study of history, you're getting onto this about where he basically enjoyed the economics.
I am going to get onto that. So when he's back at Chicago, he takes a course by an historian called Piren. And that appears to be a kind of indirect route to economics. And I'll quote him again. He said, "The most exciting modern historian I read at Chicago had been the Belgian historian Henri Piren, whose account of the end of the Roman era stressed the continuity of economic life in the face of major political disruptions. For me, Piren's shift of focus away from emperors and dreary Merovingian kings," a bit harsh on a Merovingian king, "and onto the daily lives of private citizens was novel and exciting and fit my sense of what was important." So he starts to develop a sort of an interest in economics, and particularly sort of through the vehicle of economic history. I must say, when I did economics, did you do any economic history at uni?
Not really.
I found it dull as dishwater. Mm. I probably would like enjoy it more now, but at the time I just found it incredibly dry. I thought that would
really connect with you.
I didn't really... I think, to be honest, the history I enjoy is kind of narrative history.
Right.
And it wasn't. It was just lots of sort of, well, I don't know, number crunching and so on. Anyway, so he starts to develop this interest in economics. And he can't...
But you should point out economics of the individual there. It's like the individual basis. I would argue, I mean, what you're going to find out later on, and again, it's like putting a kind of a micro framework onto macroeconomics, isn't it? And understanding the individual responses to things.
Yeah, although quite interesting, I watched an interview with him where he talked about sort of getting into Marx, and you kind of think, Lucas into Marx? But it was kind of like Marx in the sense of someone looking at the kind of structural undercurrents which explain how societies work. And it's obviously so far removed from being a Marxist, no, it's untrue, but that sort of interest in sort of the structures of society. Yeah.
But in this lecture I watched today, he says he goes back and reads the Communist Manifesto every year or something like that. He says it's a great read. And he says what he says is quite interesting about it is how the first part of it is all about how wonderful the capitalist system is.
Yeah.
So he focuses in on that.
Yeah.
And then sort of, you know, says it is actually a very, very good, explanation.
To be honest, I'm not said this before, but I'd recommend anyone read the Communist Manifesto. A, because it's really short, and B, it's far less radical than you would think.
Yeah.
When you read the sort of last page with the sort of recommendations, lots of those have actually been brought in the early 20th century.
Well, he says it's a lot easier to read. Episode, yeah, he says it's a lot easier to read than his other stuff. And that must be the influence of Engels, I would assume.
Well, I think it might have been the market, as it were, because I think it was meant to be a sort of broad-based. You know, people at the factory could read it to each other kind of thing.
But well, it is interesting about how he often reads Marx. And his thought process is why Marx ended up being wrong.
Because
you know, he says, I can understand the logic about why you'd expect something to happen. But eventually, he then quotes Becker saying that as people get more income and they've got more choices, it's the difference between quality versus quantity in terms of your kids. You know, do you send, you know, have few kids, send them to school, or do you have a lot of kids and probably stay in poverty or whatever it might be? And Marx wouldn't have foreseen that. That's kind of what he argues. No. I mean, it's... It is interesting. That's the thing about bringing in all these influences.
Yeah. No, he's definitely an erudite man, Lucas, that is. So certainly he starts to read Samuelson and goes back to his calculus, newly motivated. I think he'd been sort of switched off maths for a while. But like many others, he falls under the spell of our old friend Milton Friedman. Yeah,
Uncle Milty, who, by the way, we're recording this on the 31st of July. And that is the day he was born. It's Milton Friedman's birthday today.
Happy birthday, Milton.
Yes.
Well, there we are. So, in the fall of 1960, I began Milton Friedman's price theory sequence. I've been looking forward to this famous course all summer. But it was far more exciting than anything I'd imagined.
Yeah.
What made it so? Many Chicago students have tried to answer this question. Certainly, Friedman's brilliance and intensity and his willingness to follow his economic logic wherever it led, all played a role. You've talked about that before, haven't you? Like, just Friedman just pursues things.
Yeah. And what's great about that, because he says later on, doesn't he? He goes, Friedman's course ended my long career as a conscientious, near straight A student. Now, if a course did not promise to be life-changing, I lost interest. And you think, oh my word, imagine all those other kind of...
I know.
Have you heard what Milty's doing next door? Yeah. I like to think about it, for me.
So he's basically spoils other teachers.
Yeah.
Do you feel like you do that?
Yeah. We've got Simo. We've got Simo.
You know. See, this is why I left your school.
Why isn't every other subject as entertaining?
Well, there we are. So I'll just close off that quote about Friedman, because it is the rest of it's interesting as well. He says, after every class, I tried to translate what Friedman had done into the mathematics I had learned from Samuelson.
Yeah.
Which sort of surprised me to an extent, because I would have thought, well, perhaps not in his lectures, I would have thought Friedman would be sort of quite adept.
I just think he'd turn you over. Yeah. Just, you know, through his intellectual debate. He doesn't need numbers.
He says, I knew I would never be able to think as fast as Friedman, but I also knew that if I developed a reliable, systematic way for approaching economic problems, I would end up at the right place.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I saw that quote about basically, for a time at least, Friedman kind of ruined this sort of straight A student approach.
It's incredible. But you do get teachers like that, don't you? You're like, oh, why can't they all teach like that? You know.
Yeah. But certainly, Friedman's a real sort of shock to his system, you know, it's fair to say. He's grown up as a kind of, in that sort of New Deal Democrat milieu. And now Friedman's coming along as a libertarian conservative. It's a total rethink.
Yeah.
And it's not just about sort of discussions of sort of technical economics. It's much more about like political philosophies as much as anything else. And he describes how he voted for Kennedy in 1960. And his sister said to him, Nixon, Bob, you couldn't. And he said she was right for then.
Yeah.
So obviously at that point, he's already beginning to have sort of a change of heart in terms of his political direction, which definitely as he moves through his life, he's a sort of small state conservative, I think it's fair to say.
Without a shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. But he says, however we voted, Friedman students came away with a sense that we acquired a powerful apparatus for thinking about economic and political questions. Yeah. Which is interesting, isn't it? You kind of hope, and joking aside, that after you have taught a kid even A-level economics, you're equipping them to sort of look at the world in a different way.
Yeah.
So.
And Friedman's done it.
Yeah. Well, in quite a significant way. And certainly Lucas isn't the only one who talks about Friedman's sort of, you know, credible teaching.
Yeah. I'd love to have been taught by Friedman.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mentioned the sort of inspiration from Marx and the Communist Manifesto, but I think we've explained that, haven't we? So he gets a faculty position at Carnegie Mellon in the Graduate School of Industrial Administration, and he develops some important relationships with people he points to. You mentioned collaborative relationships earlier, and these two people in particular he cites as being particularly important sort of collaborative relationships with Leonard Rapping and Edward Prescott. And interestingly, at Carnegie Mellon is John Muth.
Yeah.
Or Muth, I don't know how you pronounce it.
Player in there.
Well, it's extremely important because you could argue that he really comes up with the idea of rational expectations that Lucas kind of formalizes and popularizes to a large degree. So that period is, really important. He does return to Chicago, though, as a faculty member in 1974. And since 1980 onwards, he's the John Dewey Distinguished Service Professor at Chicago. And he loves Chicago. He's sort of on home turf there, definitely. He talks a lot about the stimulating conversations with colleagues, the teaching, the research, particularly around all the sort of main elements of macroeconomics, like monetary theory, trade, fiscal policy, economic growth, all of that he just thinks is brilliant at Chicago. So we'll talk more about his ideas, but a little bit more about his sort of personal life. He describes his personal life as really rewarding. He's married twice. Firstly to Rita Cohen, who's an undergraduate at Chicago. They're married in 1959. Son Stephen, born in 1960, and then another son, Joseph, born later on. He does separate from his first wife, though, and there's a great story about that. Which you can explain that in a minute. I think you'll explain it better. But they separate in 1982, and then they do get divorced a few years later. But then he has a new partner, Nancy Stokey, who was a colleague at Chicago, and they've collaborated on a number of economic works, a marriage of minds,
yes,
or a meeting of minds, shall we say.
I looked up her work. She's got quite an interesting history.
So go on, you tell the story about his first wife and his Nobel Prize.
Yeah, fascinating, because in their divorce papers, they had agreed that if he had won the Nobel Prize, she would basically get half of it.
Yeah.
And basically, within 5 years, it had to be within 5 years, about 6 months before, I think it was announced. And there she was, getting $500,000.
Yeah.
Fascinating. And, it, and the irony is it, obviously, you know, because he's about future expectations.
Well, she had rational expectations.
Yeah, she did. She like, yeah. knew what was coming.
Yeah. So apparently he said at the time, a deal is a deal. She got the whole house. Getting half of the price was better than nothing. So it's funny, quite funny about that. So I think we've sort of talked about his sort of major sort of education. He's got a BA in history from Chicago and then a PhD in economics. And then I suppose the key parts of his sort of life in academia would be... firstly in Carnegie Mellon, I would say, but then, you know, obviously Chicago is his spiritual home, it's fair to say. But he does give lectures abroad, you know, the Marshall Lectures in Cambridge, the Hicks Lecture in Oxford and so on. So he's, he's a well-travelled and sort of erudite man.
And apparently he was in charge of the kind of number one economic journal in America for like 40-odd years or something.
Yeah.
So, you know, that gives him some sort of... power.
Yeah. So is there anything else you want to say about his biography before we move on and look at his
no, I don't think ideas? So. I think that was fine.
Yeah, good. Okay, let's move on.
Let's
then.
Just crack
look
on.
Key ideas. Yeah, good. So obviously the key idea is rational expectations. And
yes.
I suppose I'll explain it as simply as I can, and we can maybe add in one or two layers of complication later on. And I'll kind of use the medium of the Phillips curve to explain it.
Yeah.
I think that's fair enough. Do you agree?
And people can listen to the Phillips curve.
Yeah, they can.
Phillips podcast.
Yeah, so Alban Phillips.
This is classic A-level stuff, by the way, isn't it?
Classic A-level stuff, yeah.
Right.
So Alban Phillips publishes a paper in the late 1950s which looks at the relationship between money wages and unemployment. So in very, very simple terms, it's a kind of line of best fit. And what it appears to show is that there's an inverse relationship between those two variables. So money wages, you can see as a kind of proxy for inflation to a certain extent. And unemployment, well, obviously that's unemployment. What it appears to show is that if you want low levels of unemployment, you are going to have to accept slightly higher levels of inflation. And vice versa, if you want very low levels of inflation, you're going to have to accept sort of higher levels of unemployment.
Yeah, and that's quite in vogue at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of people saying that, like,
yeah.
now we're going to have
bring on a recession to sort of
get
bring down employment, yeah. So Phillips, to a certain extent, is just publishing that as a kind of a series of observations. But it's picked up quite quickly and sort of becomes a kind of policy tool. People sort of think, ah, right, okay, if we want to reduce unemployment, we're going to have to, I don't know, engage in sort of demand management policies, sort of fine-tune the economy, and thus bring about lower levels of unemployment, albeit with slightly higher levels of inflation. So I suppose to sort of, what underpins that is the idea that people might suffer from what came to be called money illusion. They could be seduced, if you like, back to work by higher nominal wages. And just to explain that in our current context...
I thought that was Friedman who was money illusion, man.
No, it is, but I'm sort of saying that, you know, the Phillips curve itself implies that,
okay.
you know,
yeah.
people are but Phillips points that out later on
yeah.
and says that this only works if people
okay.
suffer from sort of money illusion. So in our current context, for example, if people suffered from money illusion, they would say, oh, great, I'm getting a 5% pay increase. This is marvellous. With inflation's 8.7% or whatever it is now, it's gone down a bit, hasn't
yeah.
it? Well, that's actually a pay cut. So you're right in saying this is at first critiqued by people like Friedman. We talk about adaptive expectations, the idea that people get wise, they can be sort of temporarily...
Yeah.
sort of brought back into the labour market by what seemed to be higher wages. But then you think, oh, hang on a minute, I'm not any better off. And then might go back and join the ranks of the unemployed. Now, rational expectations takes that one step further and says, in a sense, people aren't dunces. You know, they see government policy for what it is. You know, any attempt to sort of pump prime the economy And if that brings about inflation, they're going to think, well, actually, I'm not going to go back to sort of, I can see this. I can anticipate what the effect of this government policy is going to be, and I'm going to stay put. Yeah. So to a degree, they can predict the future, i.e. have sort of rational expectations. And in a sense, what this means in terms of that Phillips curve we mentioned, whereas the original Phillips curve is a line which slopes from sort of left to right, sort of downwards, it's upright in effect, because if you're at, and where you're upright at is sort of interesting,
yeah.
But it's upright, and any attempts to sort of increase aggregate demand by cutting taxes, expanding the money supply, whatever it might be, will simply be inflationary. They will have no impact on unemployment levels.
So to flip it as well, like, well, I say flip it, just to add to it, you know, if you're an economics student who, you know, is used to drawing aggregate demand and aggregate supply curves, when you draw kind of short run aggregate supply curve, and then you push out AD, and it would go up the short run AS curve, and then it would go back, so you know the AS curve would kind of short run AS curve would shift to the left, back to its original position,
but at
and
a
then you
rate
create at a higher rate of inflation, and you so you're creating there what is known as a long run aggregate supply curve from from a Friedman perspective. You've got short run AS, long run AS.
Yeah,
Lucas blows this completely away and says, you know what,
it's not even
a short run AS.
Yeah.
The AS curve is just vertical, absolutely.
Yeah.
Blew everyone out of the water, and then suddenly it's like, right, it makes demand management, Keynesianism, completely pointless.
Yeah.
We've now got to go on a supply side crusade.
Yeah. And we should sort of just briefly sort of outline that historical context. Keynesianism, maybe not the work of Keynes, it'd be interesting, sort of an interesting counterfactual would have been if Keynes had survived sort of long beyond World War II, and what he would have made of the policies that were advocated in peacetime or in sort of non sort of depressionary times, if you like, when you haven't got a major output gap, should you then still try and sort of fine tune the economy? If you've just got a little output gap where there's a little bit of spare capacity in the economy, should the government be in the business of cutting taxation, expanding the money supply, lowering interest rates? Or is that, would Keynes actually have advocated that? But certainly people taking what they believe to be a Keynesian approach were very much in the business of sort of fine-tuning the economy, trying to predict, in a sense, where are we on the economic cycle? Are we heading into a recession? And if we are sort of heading into a recession, we therefore need to engage in counter-cyclical policies. And all of this is sort of, as you say, blown out of the water by sort of the work of
Lucas. Why, you know, he's then described by Mankiw as the most influential macroeconomist of the last quarter of the 20th century, which is interesting because he is, this idea of rational expectations is, he is focusing on a micro level about each individual. He's basically saying you can't bring about demand management on a macro scale and not even think about how the micro individual reaction is to it.
Yeah. And in a sense that, comes on as well, it will come to the Lucas critique of sort of any sort of policies.
He does say there's a famous thing that he talks about called the Lucas Islands model, isn't it? Where did you come across that? Where he talks about it, and there's another thing as well. He does this fairground analogy.
Oh, the fairground one. I read that. That was going to be one of my reading recommendations. Right.
Yeah, and kind of both within those. Surprises can have an impact. So he kind of is accepting sort of that you can get a short run AS curve, but it's got to be a complete
surprise.
Shock.
Yeah. And people can't anticipate. Yeah. And if people can anticipate what the likely outcome of government policy is going to be impotent in effect. Yeah. So he does give considerable credit to Muth, his colleague, but it was almost, you know, his work was kind of buried and, it really is Lucas who sort of popularizes it, you know, develops it in an econometric sense, and, you know, brings it to the foreground, if you like. And he's very generous in his credit to sort of Muth. He says it must be quite an experience to write papers that radical and have people just pat you on the head and say, that's interesting, and nothing happens.
Yeah, I bet, yeah.
So Do we need to say more about Rational Expectations?
Well, I suppose what we should say is that that then brings about, you know, you talk about schools in economics, the Austrian school, Keynesian, whatever. This brings about the new classical school, which is exciting.
Yeah.
New classical approach to economics.
Yeah. So in a sense, just to sort of go back, you can perhaps best understand it as a sort of critique of the Phillips curve. But it does then, as you say, form one of the building blocks of this new revival, if you like, of classical ideas, which is very much about small state rolling back of the state.
So what is the Lucas critique then? You should tell this is where it fits in.
The Lucas critique is a sort of, it's almost like a questioning. We should always hold government policy to this sort of critique or question, which is, you know, will people actually anticipate the impact of the government policy? And if they do, then that has to be incorporated into any sort of predictive analysis of what this policy will do, if that makes sense. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Well, I find it interesting, isn't it? Because it sort of backs away the whole point of ceteris paribus with models. It's like, you know, we're going to, if we cut interest rates, we expect this spending to happen, holding everything steady, like classic kind of economics. And he's basically turning around saying, well, you do know people will respond to those changes, and so everything will not hold. And therefore, you need to somehow bring that into your calculations. But then that makes it incredibly difficult to do. And so you think, right, here's the final outcome of that would be, so don't bother at all.
So I suppose some of the impacts of this, what you might call this rational expectations revolution, is certainly people should be much more aware of the importance of expectations and credibility. And you can certainly see that in the Bank of England's work. It's all about sort of credibility, you know, people sort of
forward guidance,
that forward guidance. And
and I think we said this before, Labour Party in 97, whatever, for years, you know, they used to produce these brilliant pamphlets on the pre-budget and the budget about, you know, really easy to understand little documents that would explain what's going on over the next 3 years or 4 years within their kind of government plan, you know. And so that gives confidence to people to, oh, I can invest my money because in three years' time I can see that this is going to be happening and so on. So you're building those future expectations, you know, into your policy making.
But certainly in really simple terms, expectations will change behaviour. Do you know what I mean? If people sort of are forecast to behave in a particular manner, but they're sort of almost self-aware of how they're expected to behave, then that will affect, you know, the way that they behave in the future. And certainly it's kind of knocked the confidence of maybe traditional economists who might sort of, you know, evaluate, you know, this is how we think this policy is going to work. And Lucas is saying, well, you need to incorporate into those models how people might receive and anticipate your policy. And if you don't, you know, it's almost a bit pointless.
But that in itself becomes pretty impossible to do, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because you can't get around it. Oh, do you think, like, do you know what I mean? It's that impossible. So you kind of think, it's this,
But certainly what it's led to practically is, you know, economists being less confident about being interventionist, and perhaps an indirect effect of that, certainly with the big macroeconomic levers, like sort of tax cuts, government spending. And then that allows in the sort of classical and neoclassical ideas about rolling back the state, engaging in supply-side policies instead. And certainly fine-tuning is sort of, you know, consigned to the past, if you like. Although you kind of thought, is that not what central banks are trying to do?
Well, and we'll get on to that, I think. I mean, this idea is sort of the premature death of Keynesian economics, which he was still sort of saying, you know, quite late on. You know, you still go, even though you've seen kind of Keynesianism sort of come back post 2008.
But certainly monetary and fiscal policies in this view are unable to alter the level of unemployment. They will simply not work, and the only thing that will work is supply side reforms. Yeah. Be it reforms of the labour market, or, you know, just other reforms, goods markets, whatever it might
be. Cut taxes.
Yeah,
whatever.
Exactly.
He always goes on about, if a firm is looking to invest, which he sees as like an absolute crucial factor in economic growth, those businesses want to know that in 5 years' time, A, the economy is going to be okay, but B, they're not going to be basically taxed out of existence or whatever. So you have to create that long-term environment to bring about. And that explains why, you know, you reduce corporation tax potentially over time. You say, oh, look, in 3 years' time, we're going to drop corporation tax down to 19%. Or, you know, sort of, you could argue, even though it was kind of scolded, trussonomics. You know, isn't it? In many respects, it's saying, look, we want to create an environment in 2 or 3 years' time that you as a business will get the rewards for setting up now. And hopefully that will stimulate investment, because it is clear to see, particularly within the UK, we just don't have firms that invest.
No.
You know, they're all using their money to buy back their own shares and do whatever it is, you know, and pay their dividends.
In some respects, this is where... I find that, you know, neoclassical thinking, not just Lucas, the limitation of it, I think a lot of it is the sort of almost willful ignorance of sort of institutional sort of aspects. You know, why do you get more investment in Germany than you do in the UK? Like, in genuine investment in the real economy. And some of it's just sort of long-term cultural factors, the dominance of the city and all of this, short-termism within the city. In fact, when we looked at Minsky, there was that quite interesting sort of typology of different phases of capitalism. And I can't remember exactly the name for it, but certainly we're in this kind of era of financial capitalism, which it's almost moved further and further away from, you know, the real economy, if you like. And you just don't see any of that in sort of neoclassical sort of thinking, you know, that sort of discussion about institutional factors. And I find that a bit of a dead end, really.
Yeah. Well, there you go. That's fine. You're moving on to the critiques there.
No, I am, as it were. So I think what I've talked about is rational expectations. I think I've mentioned the Lucas critique. I'm not sure I've explained it that well, but...
Yeah, I think you have.
What else would you like to...
You know, that's the whole point, isn't it? The Lucas critique is... You know, governments need to just quickly make sure they understand what they're doing and take into account
how people might respond to their policies.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Lucas Wedge, did you come across that?
You can explain.
Well, Lucas Wedge I find fascinating, because it's like the gap between where you currently are and where you would be if the best policies had been chosen.
Right. Okay.
Right. And it's different to... There's a different type of wedge,
right,
okay. Which is called... Let me just find this.
Pouring a glass of wine to stiffen my resolve for your explanation.
It's called the Oaken Gap.
Right.
The Oaken Gap. You know, like sometimes when they show on these kind of lines, like, oh, you're currently, you know, past trend was at 3% GDP growth, right? We're now like underneath that, or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So the Oaken Gap is about the difference between if you had full employment and and like your if you had full employment, where would you be on terms of GDP?
Yeah. But, okay, so there's a kind of trend growth.
Yeah.
And if you have hit that sort of trend growth, where would you be?
Yeah, and then but the Lucas wedge is the difference between... It's not to do with employment, because the like, you could have no gap, you could have no Oaken gap.
Right, yeah.
If, for example, you just got, like, if you had 100,000 people unemployed and you got them all to fill a hole.
Yeah.
It's not the most productive use, but full employment and GDP, you'd argue, you know, you're where you're at.
Yeah.
That would be the Oaken gap close. Lucas Wedge is basically saying, well, what would be the gap if you chosen the best policies?
Okay.
But as I was reading it, I was thinking...
The gap with respect to GDP, or...
Yeah, but yes.
Yeah.
You know, but you think, who decides what those best policies... It's so subjective. I thought it was really fascinating.
It must be nigh on impossible to measure.
Yeah, that's what I don't... Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, if you did this, you could... Anyway, there is something called the Lucas wage, which I thought would be quite interesting. Yeah. And then you got the Lucas paradox. Come across that one? So the Lucas paradox is the one where it's like, why do... the question is, why doesn't capital flow from rich to poor countries?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, so it's this idea that, you know, there's got to be greater returns to be had in poorer countries, so why isn't it happening? And
you mean because they've got further to grow, if you like?
Yeah, yeah. Like this should be this quick. So, and he puts it down to differences in human capital.
Yeah.
External benefits of human capital and capital market imperfections.
Right.
And I think there's something else to do with institutions as well. If you don't trust the institutions there, you know, why would you, if suddenly, like, they could just take it over, you know, why would you invest your money?
Yeah.
If they just say, we'll have
that sounds pretty valid.
Yeah. But, I mean, for me, that seems sort of self-explanatory. I don't know. I just felt it was like the Lucas paradox. It was like, yeah. Oh, they don't invest because their literacy rate is 27%.
Yeah.
You know, wow. You know, I hate to, you know, because this is the thing. It's like always, it's like art, isn't it? To go on about art. You know, it's like someone paints something completely blue.
Yeah.
And everyone's like, that's right, anyone could do that. It was the idea, innit? Yeah. He was the first person, or she was the first person who came up with a bed unmade and called it the bed, you know? And like when you look at something like the Lucas paradox, you like look at it and go, yeah. But maybe he was the first person who addressed it. Someone has kind of put an idea forward that basically, if you strengthen institutions in developing countries, then that gap closes.
Yeah.
That's the kind of thought. But it goes back again to, you know, his ideas about economic growth and the importance of human capital. And then that makes you think about like brain drains and how we encourage sometimes the brain drain, you know, within our world, as it were. So we're actually taking more and more of the human capital that they need over there, which then stops the investment happening over in those countries. So, you know, we are kind of part to blame about why that happens. And, you know, in a, I suppose, a globally unequal world, that's, you know, ultimately going to happen. Because he said, wasn't it, one of his kind of quotes, I'm sure you're going to get onto quotes, but I'm going to come in early. He says, the consequences of human welfare involved in questions about growth are simply staggering. Once one starts to think about them, it's hard to think about anything else. He said that in 1988. So by the end of it, he was, you know, kind of, I wouldn't say got rid of rational expectations, but he was very focused, on development economics. So there you go. So that's the Lucas paradox, because ultimately you do need people to invest into poorer countries.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting question to bring up.
Yes.
And I think that's about it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it's quite a broad ranging set of sort of ideas.
Yeah.
We've looked at there.
There you go. Anything else to say? I've got one more quote.
I've got a quote.
Yeah.
I quite like my quote. It's sort of about, because you sort of see him as a bit of a kind of number cruncher at times, but then he does have this kind of whimsical sort of bent as well, sort of drawing upon sort of literary figures in some of his quotes. But anyway, this is what he says about economics. We are storytellers, operating much of the time in worlds of make-believe. We do not find that the realm of imagination and ideas is an alternative to, or a retreat from, practical reality. On the contrary, it is the only way we have found to think seriously about reality. In some respects, you kind of think, oh, that's brilliant, isn't it? That sort of, we kind of have to sort of simplify things down to, well, be it models, but models are ultimately stories, aren't they? You know, we think this is how things sort of might work.
Well, that's what his Fairground Economics piece was basically about. He was trying to create that story for people to understand. But we talked about that before, haven't we? Is that I just think sometimes environmentalist economists just haven't won the day in terms of the storytelling. You know, this is the, this is the thing, and that needs to change quite quickly. Any other quotes?
No, but you said you had
I have got one, because obviously rational expectations was quite revolutionary at the time, and he said in a 1997 interview, for myself, I do not have any romantic associations with the term revolution. To me, it connotes lying, theft and murder. So I'd prefer not to be known as revolutionary.
Yeah.
And he said this about Keynes. Keynesian predictions were widely incorrect, and that the doctrine on which they were based is fundamentally flawed, are now simple matters of fact involving no novelties in economic theory.
Mm.
For someone who's quite, I feel quite open, he's so dismissive of Keynes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I find it fascinating.
Yeah.
But there you go.
He's definitely nailing his colours to the mast there.
He is. I think we should probably say that what kind of best fits rational expectations is Lincoln's maxim, which is you can fool some of the people all the time and all the people some of the time, but you cannot fool all the people all of the time.
Huh.
I think that's what...
Did he quote Lincoln or are you quoting Lincoln?
I'm quoting Lincoln there, but I think he has quoted Lincoln in the past because a lot of people talk about that.
You just say that's pretty good for you. Yeah.
I think that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, come on then.
Okay, so what do the critics say about him or his ideas?
So, firstly, on a positive note, he and Friedman were both largely right about the breakdown of the Phillips curve. You know, if you look at sort of the 1970s, they sort of predicted, you know, that it will not work, you know, this sort of trade-off between inflation and unemployment. Things are breaking down. So you have to say in a positive sense, it's an unusual case of predicting what is going to happen. So this is a sort of a bit of a mean criticism perhaps, but 5 years before the financial meltdown of 2008, Lucas says the central problem of depression prevention has been solved and has in fact been solved for many decades. Now, it might be cheap to criticise him because lots of economists could be criticised for this. But I suppose it is just because he's quite sort of strident in his views at times, you know, that perhaps you sort of think, well, you know, you're wrong, mate, and you're quite sort of keen to dismiss others as... sort of wrong. I mean, I suppose you could argue it didn't lead to a depression and maybe, you know, there's this financial meltdown, but there isn't a subsequent depression in the same way that there was in the 1930s following the great crash. You know, in contrast to the 1930s, the money supply, you know, was expanded, if you like. So maybe he's right, but the implication of the quote is sort of like, you know, it's almost like at the height of, what's it called, the Great Moderation, you know, things, or even Gordon Brown's quote, no more boom and bust. And he seems to have sort of, despite his seemingly much greater understandings of how the macroeconomy works than many other economists, he was fooled like everyone else, if you like.
Yeah.
Is that fair? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough.
I mean, there's other things that you could... maybe, I mean, I don't know whether this is a criticism of him, but the idea of rational expectations, I mean, do people learn from their sort of past mistakes in quite the way that...
I think
I read somewhere that it doesn't need everyone to have rational expectations for...
Yeah,
you only need a significant number of
people.
And maybe that's fair enough. You can't expect everyone to be rational. But I suppose a lot of interest in economics in recent years focuses on irrationality, you know, the sort of behavioural economics and so on. Does his sort of theories explain market bubbles? You know, where's Minsky and all of this sort of thing?
I think always it's like you should have a look at sort of the assumptions it's based on. So I've got it here. New classical approach as it evolved in the early 70s exhibited several important features. And then you can just kind of go down this list and think, right, do we think that's kind of true? One, a strong emphasis on underpinning macroeconomic theorising with neoclassical choice theoretic micro foundations within a Walrusian general equilibrium framework.
Right, okay.
So we've already talked about two episodes ago about Walrus's, you know, general equilibrium framework, which was like, can you actually see that? All these micro markets or whatever kind of coming together.
Yeah.
Two, the adoption of the key neoclassical assumption that all economic agents are rational. That is, agents are continuous optimizers subject to the constraints that they face. Firms maximize profit and labor and households maximize utility.
Mm.
So that's exactly what you've just been talking about.
Yeah.
Right? Agents do not suffer from money illusion. and therefore only real magnitudes, relative prices matter for optimizing decisions. So it goes back to this idea of perfect knowledge. And computation, there's no computational weakness there. And you think, you know, and then final one, complete and continuous wage and price flexibility ensure that markets continually clear as agents exhaust all mutually beneficial gains from trade, leaving no unexploited profitable opportunities. We know that's nonsense. You know, and this is the thing, is what I find kind of quite interesting about him, that the closest equivalent to him, I would argue, in the UK, and he's I think kind of quotes him or something like that, is Patrick Minford. You know, and if you have been teaching economics for years, you know, Patrick Minford comes up as a complete, I wouldn't say nut job, but because that's I'd say, but you know, like,
we've used the word nut job before, and I think we decided we wouldn't use it.
But what
I used it, to be fair.
But like, his predictions for Brexit have been absolutely ridiculed. We don't care if our manufacturing sector dies, we don't care about this. He was famously the guy who used to go around pubs in Liverpool and tell people, you can get a job, just get any job, you know, like, it's you, you know. And Lucas believes that as well. He does not believe in involuntary unemployment. He doesn't believe in it. He thinks anyone could just get a job. It comes down to the individual, you know, that they can do better. You know, and this is the thing, is that when you then think about that, you know, it's fascinating. And finally, I mean, you know, just from my perspective, there's a big thing going on at the moment on Twitter. There's a guy called Alex Williams, who's just started following us. And he's a Keynesian economist, so, you know, for EmployAmerica.org. And he's produced all these kind of data at the moment. And it's a kind of the big thing right at this moment in time, which is the frying pan curve. So, you know, what Lucas has basically said is that stimulus doesn't work. So he's got the data where he says, like, you know, average growth is 3%. After 2008, we were growing at much lower, so this idea of secular stagnation. So how come we never got back up to whatever? And then COVID's happened, and then what has now happened in America is there's been huge stimulus packages, absolutely huge stimulus packages, and it's actually got it back in America to its original 2008 line, you know? And so...
It's interesting, isn't it? Because in this country, there's a kind of debate currently, because it looks likely that the Labour Party will win the next election, but they are sort of furiously rowing back from their sort of version of the Green New Deal, because they don't want to frighten the horses, and they don't want to be seen as a party of financial mismanagement. But if you look at, you know, American politics, it seems from afar at least to be quite toxic, but that does seem to have been quite an impact of the, even this watered down version of the Green New Deal in America. And inflation is coming down, et cetera. And,
massive stimulus back. Because I asked the guy, I said, well, you know, like Lucas argues, after 2008, he's stuck in a trillion package and you could not see any shift. So what's the point? You know, that kind of fits with his, you know.
But this evidence perhaps doesn't.
Well, he says the difference is in the composition of the stimulus packages. Not every dollar enters the economy in the same way. CARES/ARP was built around cash in consumers' hands, while ARRA, A-R-R-A, was payroll tax cuts and funding for state highway projects. It matters how you do it. So, and that's true, isn't it? It's like, you know, this is the thing, is that if Lucas turns around and basically says, you know, all government spending is rubbish, you kind of think, come on, mate, it's got to be. You know, you do have to question it a little bit.
It's like lots of economists, isn't it? Is that actually data driven or is it an ideological sort of value that's sort of underpinning that worldview?
It's interesting.
One thing I did think, just in the sort of context of you know, the original Phillips curve versus sort of the modern 20th century world, is like sort of how wages are negotiated, in that perhaps would there have been strong unions in the sort of mid-19th century, like when Phillips is first writing? Certainly by the early 70s or late 60s and early 70s in this country, you get very strong sort of unions. And would that fundamentally change the nature of expectations, if you like? Because you and I, or maybe not you and I, but lots of people operating individually in isolation perhaps might suffer from money illusion. I don't know. I mean, nowadays it's all over the press, isn't it? You know, it's that cost of living, sort of BBC News 24 hours and so on. But perhaps, and as unions as well, like certainly in the public sector, who would negotiate and say, well, look, we're not going to go for this pay rise. It's rubbish, you know. But would that have been the case in the past? You know, is there a change, if you like, in... Have people become more rational over time, if you see what I mean? Like in the sense of being able to anticipate, are they more politically and economically educated? And if they're not, it doesn't matter if they're not, if their agents, i.e. sort of union leaderships, are. I don't know, does that make sense?
But I would make it the other way around, wouldn't it? That it'd be in the 70s when unions were stronger, that you would have, is that what you're saying? That it would be more rational in the 70s.
Yeah. You know,
And when he says, "Oh, you only,"
but it might be quite rational
now.
You
need a few people to do it, and those few people could be trade union leaders.
Yeah, they're union barons, and you know, Bob's your uncle, isn't it?
And that's why they then turn around and say, "Right, in actual fact, what we want to do is smash the trade unions."
No, I'm not saying I'm not, but I'm sort of I am sort of saying, you know, but there's a fundamental change there, isn't it? But even like. Knowledge, information, that the way in which we sort of absorb that now, I don't think I would have had any understanding of inflation sort of in the 1980s or 70s. Would people have done in quite the same way? Maybe they would have done. But it's all over.
But you still have it now. I mean, the fudging of stuff, you know, like even like you have Conservative MPs coming out, well, I'm sure it'd be Labour as well, to keep it, you know, who say, oh, inflation is falling, so let's see prices come down.
Yeah, well, it's not. Yeah,
yeah, and you're like, just
stupid.
Yeah, but like that's there are elected officials who don't understand inflation. So, and this is a theory based on people understanding stuff.
Yeah,
and like our actual representatives don't have a clue. So anyway,
it's like depressing. Yeah.
Right, shall we call it a day there with the old critique?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, food time, Pete. Always my favourite time where I can chomp on the mic. What are we eating today that has a spurious link with Robert Emerson Lucas Jr.?
Right, well, he is a Nobel laureate, so we could draw upon the Nobel prize-winning meals, 1995.
Yeah.
Do you want me to read out a few highlights?
Yeah. What would we be eating if we'd won that year?
Well, in 1995, that's so long that it's all in French, but you could have, I'm not quite even sure what all is, there is a croissant Nobel. It's probably not a croissant. there's petite galette de pommes de terre.
All right.
Garniture de cèpe, courge d'Italie, and noix de porc fumé. So I think that's smoked pork with Italian courgettes garnished with mushrooms.
If we have any French listeners who happen to be listening, please tell us what we're missing out on here.
Parfait Nobel en voir. That sounds nice.
Let's get onto the wine.
Washed down with a 1989 Tattinger Brut.
Oh, Tattinger
Champagne. Yeah, Saint-Emilion, 1982. I mean, it does sound nice.
Yeah.
Booze, doesn't it? But anyway, do you know what I found out the other day? And this is far more interesting. I got a really nice book for Father's Day, Atlas Obscura. I think it's Gastronomia or something like that.
Right.
Fascinating book. But it's basically just pulling on culinary curia from all over the world.
Nice.
But there is a restaurant in Sweden that will serve every meal that has ever been done at Nobel banquet since 1992.
No way.
Yeah, you have to give them advance warning, but say, right, I want the 1922 menu.
Wow.
I want the 1995. Yeah.
You must have to be loaded to go there.
I imagine you do, yeah. So the Stadhus Karlaren. Yeah. I've almost certainly butchered that. My knowledge of Swedish is beyond minimal.
It only could have been worse if you'd done it in a kind of Swedish.
It's a Muppet Show accent.
Yeah, exactly.
But anyway, I've gone really simple in the end. I just thought his parents ran an ice creamery, so I've made you some ice cream. Made it with my son today.
Magic.
Classic raspberry ripple.
Brilliant.
Yeah. By the way, I was going to try and make a Knickerbocker Glory. Remember Knickerbocker Glory?
Yeah, I love Knickerbocker Glory.
I just assumed it was like a fundamentally American thing, but apparently in America itself, they're known as a parfait. Mm. Well, there you are then. So shall I buzz off and
yes,
get you some
looking
raspberry
forward to
ripple
it.
Ice cream? This is, I put it in the freezer 6 hours ago, so it's supposed to be a no churn recipe.
Nice.
So I don't know what it's going to be like.
Yeah,
so,
looking forward to it.
Yeah. Oh well, maybe it'll be nice. Who knows? Let's go and find it.
Fetch it. Got a spoon.
Right. So, Gavin, we're back in the room. We've got our raspberry ripple ice cream. I thought raspberry ripple, it's a bit of a crowd pleaser.
Yeah.
So I don't know whether Robert Lucas Jr. enjoyed ice cream just because his parents made it. Why should he?
Well,
who doesn't enjoy ice cream, though? You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. So there we are.
There's a place in Hartford I've recently gone, and they do rhubarb and crumble ice cream.
Did you have some?
No.
No.
No, it's too much to scoop. Well,
what do you think?
That is lovely, I have to admit.
Good.
Now, while we're eating this,
don't tell me.
Quiz time.
Oh, come on. Bring it on.
Okay, now, as this is a celebratory podcast,
yeah.
that's the 50th shaker.
Yeah, I like it. Yeah.
Yeah. The quiz time is related to all things 50.
Right, okay.
Ready?
Yeah, I've just turned 51.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. Oh, don't you turn 50 this year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's not one of the, that's not one of the questions. Ready? Who said this quote? The man who views the world at 50 the same as he did at 20 has wasted 30 years of his life. Giving you three options.
Oh, good. Yeah. I think I've heard that quote before.
Muhammad Ali, George Orwell, or Oscar Wilde?
Oh, not what I thought. I thought it was going to be Karl Marx. So, Ali, Orwell, or Wilde? I'm going to go Orwell.
It's Ali!
That's poor.
Of which metal is 50 the atomic number? Gold, titanium, or tin?
So bad at chemistry. Gold, titanium, or tin? I tell you, it's a chemical element.
It's probably people screaming at the mic. I'd like to think people were screaming at the podcast now.
Right. Okay.
Rugby!
Gold?
It's tin. Okay. This is where your real strength lies.
Oh, good. I'm glad you found one.
What is 50 Cent's real name? Calvin Cordozar Brodus Jr.
Yes, that's what it is.
Oh, no.
That is it, though. Calvin
Curtis Brodus. James Jackson 3 or oh. O'Shea Jackson.
Actually, Calvin Brodus is Snoop. Yeah. So what's the second one?
It's the second one was Curtis James Jackson 3 and the third one was O'Shea Jackson.
No, it's the second one.
It is the second one.
No, Calvin Brodus is Snoop Doggy
yes,
Dog.
Very good. Yeah. O'Shea Jackson,
you bought me a Snoop Doggy Dog cookbook.
Yes.
I don't know where it is now. I think it may have made its way back to the charity shop from which
I
you bought
it from Lou.
No, you didn't.
I did. Yeah, O'Shea Jackson. I'm sure people who are out there know who are rap fans. Ice cream.
What I watched last year, by the way, digressing. Yeah. Boys in the Hood.
Oh, yeah, good film.
No, I don't think I've ever seen it before. Yeah. It's one of those things I think I should have seen. Brilliant. Really, really good. It's, you know, dated a touch, but not really. Still a really powerful film. Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
Have you seen Dead Presidents?
No.
Watch that next.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. What, according to the Royal Mint, is the rarest 50p coin? Is it Olympics wrestling, Kew Gardens, or Peter Rabbit?
Peter Rabbit.
No, it's Kew Gardens. Oh. I've got a Kew Gardens 50p.
Have you?
Yes.
How much is it worth?
They say some people have sold it for £50. I don't believe it. Yeah. I think £2 probably. Yeah. Which president features on the $50 bill? Ulysses S. Grant, Andrew Jackson, Benjamin Franklin.
Well, it's not Benjamin Franklin because he wasn't the US president. Is that what you said, US president?
Yeah, was he not?
No.
He's on a note though, isn't he?
Yeah, maybe, but he's not a president.
Interesting.
Ulysses Grant was, and who's the other one?
Andrew Jackson.
$50. Ashton's quite a controversial figure these days, but it surprised me if he's still on there. I want to go Andrew Jackson.
Oh, yeah, I thought you talked yourself out of it.
Yeah?
It's Ulysses.
Ah!
You know. But, sorry, just going about dead presidents.
Yeah.
Obviously, they've gone about the Benjamins.
All I need is my dope and dead presidents. Yeah? That's drink, slang for dollars.
Yeah.
By the way.
Yeah. Very good to look at.
I think that's from Ice Tea, though. Oh, is that Ice Cube? All I need is my dope and dead presidents.
On Kate Bush's album, whose birthday it was yesterday.
Right. Okay. Nearly shared one with Milton.
Yeah, no, she shares it with Torsten and Veblen.
Oh, fascinating.
Yeah. On Kate Bush's album, 50 Words for Snow, there's a song called 50 Words for Snow.
Yeah.
But which person spoke them? Was it Peter Gabriel, Stephen Fry, Morgan Freeman?
It's a recent album.
Relatively recent for her.
Peter Gabriel, Stephen Fry.
Yeah.
Peter Gabriel.
Stephen Fry. Can I just say, I mean, it's quite a funny, I say funny song. It's quite a weird kind of song.
I'm not a Kate Bush fan, to be honest.
But there's some great, great lines that she chooses for Snow. Blackbird Braille, Flemme de Neige, Wellissimo, Rippuccino, Sorbet Deluge, Boomerang a Blanca, Bad for Trains, Creme Bouffant, Meringue Peaks. What's the 50th word Fry says for snow?
That's part of the quiz, isn't it?
Yeah.
Go on, is there option?
No.
Snow?
Yes. And this is... last one, last question.
Can I just say this is my least enjoyable quiz?
Thank you.
Yeah, really, carry on.
Who was, and I'm hoping you're going to get this, who was the first person... And there's no clues. But the clue is, you are a supporter, you have been a supporter of this player. Who was the first person to score 50 Champions League goals?
So I'm a supporter, so a Man U player. Oh, there's a few candidates here.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's Rooney, the final quiz.
Van Nistelrooy. Ronaldo.
Ooh. Just counting what you've got so far. You've got one. One. Oh, no, you got two. You got that last question.
Van Nistelrooy.
Come on.
Rooney. Or Ronaldo. They all scored a lot of Champions League goals.
Yeah.
Rooney.
Van Nistelrooy.
Oh, I was going to say Van Nistelrooy.
You got 2 out of 7. Two out of 7. Well, thank you for the food. It was absolutely lovely.
Oh, that's so
and,
cool.
And let's really, move on.
I was really going to say Van Nistelrooy.
Well, you didn't. here you go.
I did.
Right. Okay. New question alert. We always like to compare our economist to someone, whether it's a Star Wars character or someone from James Bond. But this season, we've decided to widen our search. What fictional character is most Lucas most like and why?
I struggled with this a little bit. I thought I just ended up with some slightly sort of rubbish sort of plays on words.
Right.
I thought Pip from Dickens's Great Expectations.
Yeah.
See what I've done there?
Yeah. Yeah, I see what you've done.
Or you could go cinematic rather than literary, you know, like Spock.
Yeah. Spock.
Yeah, Rational.
Yes. Yeah, yes, good.
Or even Data from The Next Generation.
Yes, yeah. Like it.
Bit of a cheap shot, you know.
But yeah, but hey, why not? Yeah.
He seems quite into literature, by the way. He quotes Ulysses. James Joyce at one point.
Right.
Yeah. What does he say? I've got a quote here. It's important that some economists be competent historians, just as it is important that some economists be competent mathematicians, competent sociologists, and so on.
Yeah.
But there is never a need nor a possibility for everyone to be good at everything. A bit of humility there. Like Stephen Dedalus, character from Joyce, none of us will ever be more than a shy guest at the feast of the world's culture.
Beautiful, that.
Yeah, I thought it was quite
a lovely quote, that.
So he seemingly liked the ancient Greeks and also took in a bit of Joyce. So I thought maybe some kind of prophetic character, you know, Rational Expectations, you're sort of predicting the future.
Yeah.
loads of prophets in ancient Greece.
All right.
I should do a quiz about that for you. Like, which were the oracles of ancient Greece?
So that would fit in well with him because he was a historian from the start. So who are you going to say?
No, well, you could have the Delphic Sibyl. All right. Or you could have Tiresias. Yeah, Tiresias is a fascinating character. Apparently, he lived as a man and as a woman at different points in his life. Very topical.
Right, okay.
Hera, mother of the goddess, mother of the, you know, the, sorry, chief mother goddess kind of thing, said men had more pleasure during coitus than women. Zeus disagreed. Tiresias agreed with Zeus, and therefore Hera struck him blind. So Tiresias, what do you think? I don't think that very relates at all to Lucas, though.
Well, mate, I don't.
Yeah, you've got Calchas in the Iliad.
Yeah.
His name apparently means the Dark One or the Ponderer. Do you think Lucas was a Ponderer?
I don't know.
He's not a particularly sympathetic character. Uh-uh. Though, apparently one story, he died of laughter after another prophet incorrectly predicted his death.
Yeah.
So that's Calchas.
I can't imagine Lucas doing that.
No.
Dying with laughter.
No.
Although he comes across as a genial man.
Yeah, very genial. He's sort of chuckling away in the various interviews I watch.
Yeah, I do. Do you know what? I always think, like, when I was watching this lecture today, I always think is sometimes... You probably like this. I think most teachers like it, where they've got a joke they want to say, but they know they shouldn't be joking about it, so they have to hold it in, and they kind of chuckle to themselves.
Anyway. I liked him. You know, when you see him in interviews, you can't help but like him. Yeah. He just seemed like a nice sort of chap. Yeah. But anyway, we'll come to that later. So who did you have? Literary characters?
No one, really. Well, I've got... I mean, the thing is it's kind of combined with the music round. Because I mean, out of all the economists I've painted and sort of read about, I just don't think there's much to him, really. I feel with him, he's quite difficult to get to the, like, what was he like doing whatever. And so Amos Hart from Chicago,
right, okay,
musical, yeah, see like the link that,
yeah.
there, sings the song, you know, Mr. Cellophane.
What does that mean?
Oh, Mr. Cellophane.
What does it mean? What's
people that? Just look for him. Oh. I know they didn't look for him because he obviously won the Nobel Prize. Oh. But do you know what I mean? Like, I wouldn't notice him in a crowd. Where you would. You could imagine, like, Freeman holding God. Hey, guys. Yeah. You know?
I think it's just the lack of information, though, isn't it, ultimately?
Yeah.
I struggled to find biographical detail, but...
Yeah. There you go. Anyway, right. Let's go for one of yours.
Tiresias, fascinating character.
Okay. Right. If Lucas was a boxer... Oh, no. What books would we recommend if people wanted to learn more about Lucas and his ideas?
Well, the main one I'd recommend, because I think it probably much more succinctly and... I don't know what the word is for it. Effectively, perhaps, explains his idea. He's his own essay about fairground economics.
Right. Okay.
And he uses the analogy of a fairground, which you could argue has its own monetary system, to explain the relationship between the money supply and inflation and anticipated versus unanticipated changes. So if you reduce the number of tickets you're given for your dollars, in effect, it reduces the money supply and causes a depression in the park. And basically, sort of says, if people don't anticipate it, it has a genuine effect.
Yeah.
But if they do anticipate it, it kind of doesn't. Mm. Yeah. So, but it's quite an entertaining.
It shows
essay,
off his good writing. I mean, I saw this video of one of his colleagues saying even his emails are beautifully written.
Yeah. It's really well written. It's really sort of, just as you say, well put together. And I think if you wanted a simple but effective explanation of his main ideas, well, he does it a lot better than we do. So I'd recommend that. And we could put out a link to that because that is available online.
Yeah.
Anything else you'd recommend?
Yeah. I think I sent you this book because there's a really long interview in there with him.
Oh, yeah.
Which is called Modern Macroeconomics, Its Origins, Development and Current State by Brian Snowden and Howard R. Vane. You can read it online. We will post it.
Yeah.
And it has a brilliant interview with him. What I found a lot of the time quite interesting about that interview is where a lot... He says I don't know that area. I'm not going to talk about it.
Yeah.
Like, he says it in one of the lectures, actually. They ask him about the Euros crisis at the time.
Yeah.
And he says, I don't understand what's the problem with, like, Greece leaving the Eurozone.
Mm.
Which I thought was a bit odd, really. Because you'd think...
That's, well, you could look at that in two ways. You could say it's admirable, because a lot of people... a lot of people I know will just opine about anything.
No, I know that.
But there again, you could sort of... Yeah.
You'd thought you'd just not... I mean, that's a big thing, isn't it? Having like a Eurozone crisis. And, you know, how American kind of was he in his thinking? I find that just quite...
Sort of a narrowness.
Yeah, and there's a guy that we follow, and he follows us. And he is a journalist, BBC, and other places. And he's called Padraig Belton.
You pronounce that Porik.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Porik Belton. And I do apologise to Porik.
Sorry. Like Porik Harrington.
Right, okay. And
golfer.
And And he has a book called An Analysis of Robert E. Lucas Jr.'s Why Doesn't Capital Flow from Rich to Poor Countries?
Right, okay.
So you can get a hold of that.
Sounds
and
good.
I would say that books that we've mentioned before, Noel Kashtani's Short History of Economics.
Such a good book. I can't recommend that enough. Yeah. I'm always recommending that to kids.
It's a good book. And there's a bit in there about it. There's a bit in called The Big Economics DK book that we have. Another really good piece on that. I think, you know, 30 Seconds Economics, I think, is a piece in that. So there are these little bits that you can kind of read on him that are really, well, shorter than this. Okay.
Good.
If Lucas was a boxer, what would his walk-on music be and why?
I've only got one, really. I thought Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. It's possibly... I'm not a massive Beatles fan. I really like that song.
Yeah, I don't really know that one. It's the genre.
It feels really modern if you listen to it. It's just got a great sort of drum beat. Yeah. It just sounds like something from 1990s Manchester.
Well, there you go.
Well, I'd really recommend it. That's from the album Revolver, I think.
Classic album.
I think it's from that anyway. Could have just made it up. Yeah.
Okay.
But Tomorrow Never Knows, obviously, you know, Rational Expectations.
I've gone for, last time, I was hoping to get two Who songs in a row, because last time we did, I could see
Won't
miles.
Get Fooled Again?
Won't Get Fooled Again!
Do you know what? That is one of my favourite songs.
It's brilliant.
If you listen to the extended version,
yeah,
that sort of bit in the beginning. Yeah, it seems to go on forever.
Have
it's
you ever
so
seen
good.
The version that they do, I say they do, Roger Daltrey, and who's the guitarist?
Pete Townsend.
Do with Jimmy Fallon
Late Show,
Children's Toys.
Oh, no, yeah.
That's brilliant. Like playing like the kazoo and like the, I don't know, like tambourine. It's so good. And then Townsend's playing like the ukulele. Do Won't Get Forward Again. It's so good.
The Who are such a talented band. Anyway, I could digress.
And then what I thought I'd do is discover, look, I thought, you know, he is basically the leader of the new classical school.
Yeah.
What's going on with classical music these days?
Right, okay.
So I looked up the 10 great composers, thanks to Classic FM, who are shaping music for the 21st century.
Right, and who are they?
It's quite a few. It's Max Richter.
I think I know Max Richter.
Ludovico Einaudi. I really liked his one. It's called Elegy for the Arctic. He basically is playing playing piano
on an ice floe
on a glacier.
It sounds a bit gimmicky.
Ah, it's beautiful.
Okay.
I kind of want to play it now, but it probably have copyright issues. And then there's loads basically. There's not loads. 10. Hans Zimmer. But there's one down the end here, which. You know when suddenly you feel like your life hasn't been as fulfilled as it should do? Alma Deutscher, 17-year-old composer, pianist and violinist, is one of the brightest young stars of her generation. She wrote her first piano sonata at the age of 5 with a short opera, The Sweeper of Dreams, followed just 2 years later, so when she was 7. In 2016, when Deutscher was 11 years old, Zubin Mehta sponsored the European premiere of her first full-length opera, Cinderella. When Deutscher was 13, She moved to Vienna with her family, described the Austrian city as a musical homeland, having grown up on music of Mozart, Schubert, blah, blah, blah.
Can you believe it? They're like five.
In 2021, aged 16, she was admitted to the conducting degree at the prestigious University of Music and Performing Arts Vienna, where her predecessors including Zubin Mehta, Claudia Abadou, and Kirill Petrenko. She's 17.
Can I just say
my son won't get out of bed before 4 p.m.
Can I just say they're five? Do you believe that? Five?
That's what it says.
Come on. I reckon that's one of those.
17, she's doing all that.
Yeah, but five, come on.
I'm just saying. Yeah, what makes up a piano sonata? Could be, I don't know. Anyway, I don't want to criticise it, because, I mean, it's 17, she's doing all that.
It's obviously a very impressive young woman.
But anyway,
right, anyway, carry on.
Should we go for... Come on, let's do Who. Two
yeah.
in a row.
Oh, yeah.
Won't Who. Get fooled yeah, again.
It's a fantastic... It's one of my favourite songs.
Yeah, brilliant.
Fantastic
okay. song. Okay, it's... Poetry Corner.
Right, fantastic.
You've got a line there
I
to
have,
read.
Yeah. Right, I'm going to rustle my papers dramatically.
Yeah, good, like right, it.
Okay.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Who's the economist that ripped up the script and put Keynes's ideas in the crypt?
Robert Lucas is the man you seek, a Nobel Prize winner at his peak. Known for his idea about rational expectations, where consumers made lots of calculations about new information that came their way, not adapting their choice from yesterday. It led to a supply-side revolution, with governments finding absolution from their sins of Keynesian tax and spend that created a cycle that would never end. You can't fool the people all of the time, as the new classicals would surely chime. But did this rationality really exist? And isn't the point of the government to assist? Should the state really be shrinking? That's the point of Lucas. He gets you thinking. During the 80s, he did rule as the leader of the New Classical School.
Brilliant. Another tour de force.
I mean,
whew,
magic.
Yeah, yeah.
So, do we like him? Will we have a beer with him? I couldn't even find out if... Is he a drinker?
To be honest, I struggled a bit for biographical detail beyond that which
yeah.
he shared.
Tough.
And the amusing anecdote about his wife. You know, his first wife.
Yeah.
I
bet he had a drink on that day.
In a sense, I did like him. When you see him sort of being interviewed, he just seems really genial.
Yeah.
You know, you think, oh, he's good company.
Yeah.
I'm sure he was, you know. And he's obviously open to discussions.
Yeah.
You know? I'm sure we'd have a nice time. Could have an ice cream.
And you could probably find out stories about Friedman.
Yeah.
What he was like.
Yeah.
Quite interesting.
God, tell us more about Milty.
Come yeah, on. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
but no, I think...
What would we do with him?
Mm.
Well, you said, go for an ice cream.
We'll go for an ice cream, yeah.
I wonder what he would feel. Maybe this is a question for the next question. About a Mr. Whippy compared to classical ice cream. Because it's a real... I'm a big Mr. Whippy lover.
My wife loves Mr. Whippy.
Yeah.
I'm a bit like... I don't know, it's a bit ITV versus
yeah,
BBC.
Exactly, we're in reverse. My wife is exactly the same. She loves proper classical ice cream.
Yeah.
But I'm a Flake and a Whippy man every day. Yeah.
So do you think Flake and a Whippy is sort of Keynesian ice cream? Or or is it the other way around?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Tough one to call. Yeah. Right. We like him. Okay. If we were out with him, what one question would we ask him and why?
Well, I think I'd ask him about... I might ask him about the crash, and I'm not in a sort of, oh, you didn't predict the crash. I might ask him, you know, what role did or could rational expectations play in the 2008 crash? He's obviously a monetarist as well, you know, like, you know, strongly influenced by Friedman. I'd probably ask him about, you know, the current high levels in the UK. What is causing this? You know, what does this have any sort of light to shed on your theories?
Mm.
Yeah? Yeah. What would you ask him?
Well, I mean, he knows the importance of human capital. And at the same time, in this kind of lecture I watched, he was like, why should rich people pay more tax?
Mm-hmm.
And then you kind of think, well, if
to
you believe
the quality
in,
of human capital.
Yeah, exactly. Where does that link come in?
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting when he mentions the Communist Manifesto and about how it bigs up whatever, you know, clearly in the Communist Manifesto, why... He then talks about quality and quantity of kids and the importance of education. Well, where did that education come from? It's government spending and things like that and intervention. And I mean, you could argue, well, that is supply side economics. So maybe it does fit in with the ideas that when you're spending money, at least it's got to be supply side. But it's interesting when you work through. I think it's like everything. You just want to go through those assumptions with him and say, "Do you like? Have you seen people?"
Yeah. Well, to be honest, to be fair to him, he might have a more nuanced view of all these things. And
yeah, which we've always said with all the economies you look at.
Yeah.
Nuance is everything.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So, who is it next time? What's happening?
Well, I've got no idea. I think we have an idea for a special, but I don't want to give the game away.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
Yeah. Watch this space.
Yeah.
We hope to be leaving our studio / my dining room to take on a more roving role.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
We just hope we can pull it off.
Yeah. We've had a request for Jevons. Yeah. So we're thinking about Jevons. Yeah.
From my old alma mater.
Yeah. And potentially we might be doing a music special. So we've got a few things in the pipeline.
And Becca.
Like you're saying,
okay, coming back to Becca. Where is Becca?
Watch this space as we say. So this is it. This is the 50th. I was trying to find one of those new things.
Yeah,
I couldn't find one. This is the 50th episode.
Well, I put a lot of effort into that shaker. Yeah.
Okay, so thanks everyone. If you've been here from the start of our journey, from 1 to 50, first of all, well done.
Yeah, well done
for
indeed.
For persevering.
Yeah.
But we'd like to thank you for listening and hope that you will listen to our next podcast. We'd also like to thank our friend Nick, as always, who gives us technical advice with regards to podcasting. And please do follow us on Twitter and Instagram at EconomicsIn10 or Mastodon, I think. We haven't moved on to Threads yet and Blue Sky.
Yeah, but who knows?
Considering it, you know. Yeah. Or let's contact us the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, economicsin10@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. And also, don't hesitate to review us on iTunes or whatever platform it is you download our wonderful podcast from. We love feedback, good or bad.
Yeah, I think we should point out that you can listen to this on Amazon now.
Yeah, that's exciting.
Not that we're advertising Amazon, though. Down with...
No, but more, you know. The more platforms in which you can download these gems, the better.
Exactly.
Yeah.